Welcome to Get Real, Talking Mental Health and Disability. I'm Robin Hayden. Today we're continuing our conversations about the findings of the Royal Commission into Victoria's mental health system. These findings, as I'm sure you're aware by now, are really going to reshape mental health services, not just in Victoria, but potentially across Australia over the next decade. The focus of this episode is on the recommendations for reform specific to carers, people who care for a family member or friend, often in an unpaid capacity. There are, for context, around 60,000 carers in Victoria caring for an adult with a mental illness. They often don't get the recognition they deserve for providing this vital role. 9,000 of these carers are young carers, aged up to 25 years old. And carers provide a service that would otherwise fall on the health system. In Victoria, they provide $3.7 billion worth of unpaid care annually. You probably know a carer in your own life. There are a lot of carers, but people often don't identify as carers. They see themselves as caring for someone that they love. And our very first episode of Get Real was about the experience of carers, and it's our most listened to episode to date. So we know that there's a real interest around the challenges and needs of this very important group of people. And now in episode 42, I'm really delighted to be able to welcome some new carers to talk to us today. So the Royal Commission findings, for those who aren't across this, have some very specific recommendations that are going to affect carers, including the recommendation for 8 family and carer-led centres across Victoria, and elevating the leadership and promoting the valued role of family members and carers throughout the mental health and wellbeing system. So our guests today are Karen Rule and Susan Lovegrove, two women with lived experience of caring for a loved one with a mental health condition or a disability, and they've also channeled this to provide their learnings and experience through advocacy and support to others. So welcome, Karen, and welcome, Sue.
Hi.
Lovely to have you both with us. It's been quite a day already. So as we're recording this, this is the day of the earthquake in southern Australia. So we've all been talking about that. And, you know, there's lots of things going on in the world at the moment. And I think sometimes the challenges that people are having on an individual basis can feel a little bit overshadowed by what's going on in the bigger and broader world. So I think first it would be really great to have just a chat about you guys and your experiences as carers, both personally and professionally, because I know that you both sort of have walked in both those shoes. So Karen, if I can start with you, what's your experience as a carer personally and professionally?
Well, I guess I'll just say a bit about myself. I've got two daughters, 26 and 22-year-old. Mm-hmm. My youngest daughter had her first psychosis over 5 years ago. 5 years ago in May 2016, when she was 17, she was finally diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, and that sort of changed things because having a more accurate diagnosis, we got better treatment. She's now we found that putting her on some hormone regulating medication that actually evened out the mood disorder part of schizoaffective disorder. Yeah. And so we've actually started making quite a bit of progress since then. And we're now working toward the minimum amount of medication that gives her the best quality of life. She's also had the added challenge of being on the autism spectrum, and that can affect her language. When she goes into fright and flight, she can also go into freeze where she just can't speak. There's been a lot of misunderstanding of that with professionals. Sometimes I think she's just not being cooperative, and it's not that. It's just that she literally can't speak. Mm. So I'm kind of her translator, and that was very hard in the start because when people didn't understand that and they didn't want me there, they perceived it as being controlling. That was the last thing on my mind. I just wanted to make sure that they understood Brianna and Brianna understood them. But we've come a long way in this, and where we're at now is a lot better. And I'm now on an advisory committee or a couple of different advisory committees trying to make things better for the future. I did a big submission to the Royal Commission, and, yeah, feeling a lot more positive about things.
So a steep learning curve and a very long journey within what's, I suppose, in the space of someone's lifetime, actually a relatively short period of time. How does that feel for you? Does it feel like it's been a long journey in a short space of time?
Yes, sometimes I look back on some of the notes and I think, wow, did we actually go through all of that? It's just amazing. It's really nice now because of what we've been through. Now when things are calm and they're good, it's just we don't take anything for granted at all.
Yeah.
We've learnt so much out of this, and that's why we'd like to pass on to other carers what I've learnt. Yes, probably the most important lessons that we've learnt is how to calm your brain and understanding your brain and your mind and your body, how it all works. You know, we practice these things every day now, such as this morning I was practicing my self-care in the bath just when the earthquake hit. So, yeah, that was pretty funny watching the water ripple. But, yes, as I was saying earlier, yep, I resisted the urge to jump up and run out the front because that wouldn't have been good and decided to stay in the bath where it was safer. And safer for everybody else too.
a bit of an out of body experience almost going through all of that, and you know, there's a surreal aspect, I suppose, to going through something like an earthquake, which is not something that we're all in Melbourne, not something that we've really seen at that level in our lifetime. So yeah, it's a but also in your experience, all of those learnings that have layered on top of one another as you've learned to, you know, manage and you and your daughter together through this process, and along with the people who support her. Really looking forward to unpacking some of that with you today. So thanks, Karen. And Sue, can you tell us a little bit about your experience of being a carer, both personally and professionally? Yeah. What's your story?
Well, Michael was born 29 years ago, and from the start we obviously knew he had an intellectual disability because he was diagnosed as being Down syndrome. So right from the start it was a double whammy. My husband and I were both quite devastated because whilst we want to celebrate the birth of our child, it was like we had lost that real child, you know, the one that we were expecting. So it took a lot of time to sort of come to terms with it. And yeah, a bit overwhelming at first, particularly, I guess, the first day when people wanted to come and visit and we didn't want them to come and visit. And when they eventually found out that Michael was Down syndrome, it was interesting. No one really knew whether to congratulate us or commiserate with us, you know. And I guess that's exactly how we were feeling at the time. So, yeah, I had no family support in Melbourne myself. Michael had to go from a private hospital to Monash neonatal because he was actually 4 weeks prem as well.
Yeah.
And I just booked myself out of the hospital because what's the point of being there if your baby's not there? During the time he was in hospital, you know, we got to talk about things, and of course my mind was running, what's his future going to be like, what are we going to do, and what's going to happen when we die, and who's going to look after him? He was only 5 minutes old and I was worrying about that far ahead, you know. And eventually my husband sort of just said, calm down a bit. And yeah, we just sort of all of a sudden I kind of woke up one day and went, okay, that's it, here's our child. We just have to do what we have to do. I'm quite pragmatic in most things in life, and I think that just kind of instinctively kicked in. And, you know, I decided I was going to be the greatest world advocate for people with Down syndrome. That didn't quite work out as I planned. But anyway, it was something to aim for, something, you know. And I absorbed all the information that was given to me. The hospital had a pack, actually, that was supplied by the Down Syndrome Association in anticipation. And they'd actually had 4 babies born in the first half of that year who were Down syndrome, which was kind of like a little bit over the average. But we just decided that, you know, he's going to be able to learn things. that's just going to take a little bit longer. That was the advice. The Down syndrome also sent a parent with their child to visit and chat with us. So, you know, it was very positive, and, you know, we got lots of support from that. And, you know, his health and his intellectual ability is as diverse as in the general population. Mm. And some of his characteristics, there's 120 that you can name, but, you know, one child might only have five of those characteristics. So that's the sort of thing that I was learning about it. And, you know, we just ended up going with the flow and ended up having two more boys, which I thought was great. It was a bit of a handful because they were very close together. But anyway, we're past that now. He's now 29. He's probably a little bit more difficult now because he does have his own mind made up about certain things. And prior to his birth, I was just working in the corporate Coles Myer as a PNC manager, Coles supermarket managers. And I'd actually been made, the position made redundant. And when Michael was born, I realised that, you know, it's probably better if I just stay at home. So I just took the package. We just got on with our lives. We bought a supermarket, managed that for 18 years. Wow. Then we sold it. Then I decided to study, did the degree, graduated last year. Haven't had my ceremony yet. I'm waiting to that.
What's your degree in, Sue? Just so I know, but what, just to tell everybody else.
Bachelor of Social Science in Psychology. That was a big struggle, but, I made it. And started working casually here at Irma, and I'm still here and I love it.
Congratulations. That's a big achievement and a really big wide arc of a journey as well, you know, 29 years and the changes that have happened, I guess, in your life in that lifetime. And I think what both of you have spoken about, you know, in introducing and telling us your story is just the amount of learning that you had to do that you probably weren't expecting to have to do about how you manage as carers. So it's a real lifelong learning, isn't it, by the sounds of it?
Being a new mum and not having that much family support as well, I mean, it's hard enough if you have a normal child, shall I say, there's italics there. But when they have a disability, it's everything that they do, you think, is that normal, or is that because, you know, he's Down syndrome? Even a coughing in bed and, you know, choking on a piece of toast, is that normal? Or I know he has smaller, you know, tubes and things like that. Is that because he's Down syndrome? You know, it was sort of a big panic, a double panic every time he did something that, you know, caused me concern. I mean, one day it took me an hour to chop up a carrot because he kept coughing upstairs and I had to keep running upstairs to see whether he was okay. You know, I was quite paranoid, but that may be the same as a mum who has a new baby who doesn't have any intellectual disability. So, you know, it was just like I was just on edge all the time for the first couple of months, 3 months, 4 months. So, yeah.
Karen, can you relate to that?
I was very fortunate that with my youngest, who we sort of worked out very early on that there was something a bit different, and that's because she was my second child. So I think it was a lot easier in that regard because I had, my first daughter did everything a bit early, if anything. In fact, she got the nickname Houdini because she could get into any child lock, and she managed to climb out of the cot and she now rides a big black motorbike. Always had a bit of an adventurous spirit. the second one, she's it was just a bit of a different journey. She found her niche with dancing, and then she caught up with her peers and did really well. So I'm very proud of both of my daughters and the people that they are and how they push themselves to do their best. And, yeah.
Yeah, Yeah, absolutely. And it sounds like for both of you, those very different sort of benchmarks you have when it's your first child versus it's your second child, and knowing what to expect, it really just does underscore, doesn't it, that all kids are different and all life journeys are different, and you just get what you get, and it's a surprise, and, you know, life really is a journey that we're working through. I think both of you have probably in some ways referred to this next topic that we're going to explore a little bit, which is around impacts to carers themselves as carers. And I know that, you know, Tandem Victoria, who are the peak body for mental health carers in Victoria, they made a submission also to the Royal Commission, and they said that carers often face substantial impacts in every part of their lives, including their own mental health, and that the system can fail carers when it fails those that they care for. So is that statement true for you both, and can you share perhaps some of your own personal experiences of this?
I actually found Tandem an absolutely wonderful support. I wouldn't have got through them without this. They referred me on, they just gave me a lot of information. They explained what carer rights were and helped me work through that when I had problems. They also helped me put a submission into the Royal Commission.
Yeah.
So if for any carers, if people with mental health issues, if you haven't signed up to Tandem, I highly recommend it. They are a great organisation, and they're very good in advocating for carers.
Yeah, no, I suppose that Tandem, obviously fantastic organisation and a great support, so it's good to hear that, you know, that's been really helpful to you. I guess what they're alluding to or did in their submission is that, you know, when the system, the service system itself fails the people that carers support, it fails the carers, and the impact is then on the carer's own mental health. So, yeah, does that kind of resonate with you, or is your experience different? It might be.
Yeah, I guess if we're not functioning well, then we can't support the people that we're wanting to support. So I guess I've learnt that I have to look after myself first.
And how about you, Sue? I mean, I guess if things don't go well for your son and something happens to him, I guess by association it happens to you and your family. What's that been like for you?
Yeah, well, because I was caring for him since he was born, I didn't even think of myself as a carer, as you alluded to earlier on. It was just my job as a mother. I guess the rubber hit the road, or I kind of fell into a hole after my third son was born. 21 months between the first, the second and third, and, you know, 2.5 years between Michael then. I have a photo at home where all three of them are lined up on the outside of the bath, and all three of them have nappies on. And I thought, how did I manage to do nappies, you know, for three children all at once, sort of thing? It was just, you know, I look at that photo and think, I just don't remember that part of my life, really. It was just go, go, go. I did fall into postnatal depression after Jonathan as well. And I think that's when I started to hear about caring for yourself, otherwise you can't care for others as well. So I do, this is going to sound horrible, but I do remember just completely losing the plot with the boys at one time, and I was grabbing Michael and just shaking him, and I thought, oh, what am I doing? I sort of quickly realised that this is not right, something wasn't right. Went straight down to the maternal health nurse, and I told her what I had done. I didn't get arrested. I thought I should have been. But she said, you and she asked a few more questions. She said, you are displaying all the signs of postnatal depression. You need to go to the doctor and you need to speak to them. So the local GP, she put me up to medication and worked through a few things that I needed to do. And the first thing I did was someone said, go and, you know, ring up Monash Council, because, you know, they have a carer's sitting facility, you know, babysitting kind of thing. So the doctor recommended that to me and wrote a letter. So I got a 4 hours a week on a Friday afternoon for as long as I wanted at that point, just for me. Well, I didn't know what to do the first Friday. It was like, you know, you see those the pictures of moon bears being let out of their cages for the first time ever, you know, and they're kind of picking up their feet on the grass and going, sniffing around and going back into the cage. That's what I felt like. I felt like, what am I supposed to do? Because I've usually had three kids with me, pack them all in the car, go do the shopping and come back. And here I was on my own. I just sat on the park bench. I just sat on a park bench because I didn't have anything specific to do. I had no plan at all, which was great. And, you know, after a few weeks, I decided that I needed to do something for me during that time. And, you know, subsequently I did find lots of nice shopping things to do and catching up with friends. And it was so nice to be able to just do that without having children crawling all over you or running away from you. Michael ran away from me once in the shops and I thought, oh, if he's going to go out in that car park, he's going to die because no one's going to see him and he has no sense. And, you know, but I didn't have to worry about that. It was just, it was just a great time then. And, you know, that service was available to me for up until the age of Michael was about 16. So if we needed to go anywhere at night time or at a wedding, there was always someone there to look after the children for us. So that was at an amazingly reduced rate. So I took advantage of that as much as I could. But, you know, it was just what I had to do. Like everyone says, it's your child and you just look after them. And I had no thought of looking after myself at all.
Yeah.
I got that service.
And getting help for your own mental health, was that help? That was part of it, but getting treatment and recognising early that there was postnatal depression going on, was that helpful in sort of preventing that from getting worse?
Yeah, it was. I then understood why I was feeling the way I was feeling. And even after the second child, Anthony, was born, I actually developed rheumatoid arthritis. And I just kept thinking I was really tired and my legs were sore and my hands were swollen. I couldn't put the pin through the nappy. And I think that added to it as well. You know, I'm sort of on medication for that. And that kind of went away after a year or two. But in the meantime, I'd had Jonathan and then the postnatal depression on top of it. So it was, painful and, you know, just
stressful.
I was just losing it completely. So, but having recognised it, that obviously makes a huge difference, and accepting it as well, saying, okay, well, we need to just work through this. I didn't have any psychotherapy or anything. It was just mainly medication and just the free time for myself. Was what really got me through too.
It's sad that often for us carers that it's not until you have a breaking point or get close to it that can be the turning point. And I guess like you were saying there, Sue, for me it wasn't until I had been referred onto a carer group through Uniting Care, and I read out a poem and sort of finished with. I thought that the only time I was going to get a rest is when I died, and I sort of got ushered out of the room. that's not a good thing to say in front of our other carers. but I was in a dark place. But I guess it's when you hit bottom that you end up getting help, which I did. And I actually got referred on to Irma, and, thank you so much, Julie Humphreys, if you're listening. The education that I received was really wonderful as far as setting boundaries, learning how to care for myself, all that sort of got me better mentally to cope and get my own life back on track. There was even a course that I did on rebuilding your life through Wellways, and one of the goals I set for myself was getting back into the drums, which I have now. So that's another little self-care thing that I do. It is a journey, and it's very difficult at times, but being brave enough to ask for help is really important.
Yeah. And, you know, we've talked about I mean, you've both already talked about how self-care and self-compassion, I think, is something that is really important for carers, because you're often so busy, looking after other people's needs. It's understanding, and I've heard this referred to, as putting on your own oxygen mask first so that you can help others. You've probably heard that analogy as well. And, you know, I did hear from talking to carers in our last episode that, you know, carers don't have a lot of time for themselves. Their needs will often come last when it comes to, you know, caring for a person with complex needs. So you've mentioned a couple of things already, but are there other strategies that you find helpful in taking care of yourself so that you can care for your loved ones? So the breaks, the time out, the playing the drums, you know, the reaching out for support. What else have you found helpful personally? Karen, if there's anything that you can think of.
I think in looking after myself and modelling that for my daughter, it's actually helped her mental health as well. So when I'm starting to feel overwhelmed, if my go-to is, I'm starting to feel a bit overwhelmed, I need to go and have a cup of tea outside in the garden. I've got a hammock seat out there, and I actually bought one for my daughter as well. So we've both got our little hammock seats that we can sit and chill in. The other thing I do is go for walks, have a bath. But these little steps, modelling that, she's actually doing those things now. So when she starts to feel herself going into fight and flight, she will go for a walk. She'll have a hot shower or a bath. It's modelling it to her has actually, it's helped us both, and that's where I really feel like it's been a team effort, and where we are now is just so much better than where we were. It's good.
Yeah, that's awesome. How about for you, Sue? What works for you, apart from the things you've already mentioned?
I don't know. I find, I remember on Mother's Day, someone said, what do you want for Mother's Day? And I said, I want a weekend away. My husband said, oh, that'll be nice. I said, no, just by myself. He said, well, what are you making? I said, no. I don't want anyone to come with me. I just want to sit on the bed, read a book, or just, well, they didn't have binging in those days. But, I just don't want to do anything. And I don't want to have anyone around. Because as a mum, you sort of like, you do everything most of the time. As the kids got older, it got easier because they weren't so dependent on me. Mm. I've always loved to walk, and I'm still walking. So, the exercise, I started going to the gym. What else? Yeah, just reading, and I like doing creative stuff. I did a whole series of scrapbooking at one stage, just sort of putting myself in the zone. And now that they're much older and some have left, the garden is my passion, and jam making now during COVID, and furniture restoration.
So all those things that, and they're very personal things, aren't they, for both of you? It's like you find something that gives you time out, and you find something that works for you, and you build that into your day, or you build it into your week, so that it just becomes something that's your go-to, I guess, when things are getting stressful or overwhelming, by the sounds of it.
I was very naive when I had Michael, because in terms of what how much care babies need, because I thought I might be able to take up the piano again. I think that would be nice. And as I mentioned before, it took me an hour to cut up a carrot one day. I thought, well, there's no way I'm going to be able to sit down and practice any piano. And you don't do that while they're sleeping, do you?
No.
It just took a long time for me to just sort of find things that I could do. But, I'm not very good at looking after myself. I'm just one of those person that goes, I'll be okay. It's gotten easier. It's gotten better, but I'm still not really good at it. I just keep myself busy. That probably is my thing, keeping myself busy.
Yeah, I guess I've learned it's like our phones, if you just keep using them and they're not getting recharged, soon they'll, if they get to completely flat, it takes much longer for them to recharge. So it's a case of not having too many apps going at the same time, draining the batteries.
It's a good analogy, isn't it? Yeah. But,
well, one that my daughter actually then understood. So, yeah, just explain how, you know, I have to have this time and I've got to look after myself. She's actually had to go into supported accommodation. It was taking its toll on my body because I've got a couple of immune disorders with Crohn's and lupus, and actually a lot of carers end up with fibromyalgia because it just takes a toll on your body, burning the candles at both ends. And as mothers in particular, or parents, we feel it's our responsibility. And it's only through doing some of the education around caring and realising that I actually have a responsibility to myself to look after myself. Otherwise, who's going to look after my daughter if I'm not here? So, yeah, I've taken all the education that I can, and it's particularly the one on setting boundaries and rebuilding my own future. All of those things have made a difference at working out what it is that I actually enjoy doing. It's good to feel like I'm getting my life back on track. And actually me being happier is actually in turn making my daughter happier. When we have time now, it's not like, the carer relationship that it was, where she used to kind of hold on to me for grim death because I was her only support. Now that there's other supports as well, and we've got a team of people now, and so it's not all up to me. We now have this side-by-side mother-daughter and sometimes just friendship. We just enjoy each other's company walking along side-by-side. It's just so lovely, and it's even helped with my other daughter now. You know, like we're just getting back to be more of a normal family again.
Yeah. And that's something I think that, you know, you're both remarkable in what you're doing and how you're managing. And, you know, something I think we've all learned over the past 18 months is that none of us are immune. None of us are invincible. You know, we all have points that we have to recognize that we get to where we need to provide our own self care and to recognize when things are perhaps going not quite as well as they could, and it sounds like you've both got some really great strategies to deal with that. So thank you for sharing that. Let's have a chat about advocacy now, because, you know, through lived experience, carers can be a really powerful voice for advocacy, both for the people that they care for but also for themselves. So I want to talk a bit about what advocacy has looked like for both of you. So I know, Karen, you've said you made a submission to the Royal Commission, and it's great that you felt able to do that. Do you both feel able to have your say when it comes to advocacy and ways to transform the systems in which you are being provided care? Because, you know, obviously the Royal Commission into Mental Health, massive opportunity to get some change. So I really like to speak to you specifically about that, Karen. But then Sue, also, you know, what advocacy has looked like for you and where you felt able to contribute and what that's looked like for you. But I might start with you, Karen, because you've mentioned your submission. How did that come about for you, and what was it you were advocating for with the Royal Commission into Mental Health in Victoria?
I guess I've been in touch with Tandem for assistance, and they knew what a difficult time I was having with the staff back at that point, where they didn't seem to have an understanding of the Carer Recognition Act or Section 346, subsection 2HI of the Mental Health Act, which I got to know quite well, where they are allowed to give information to carers in relation to their role. It was actually a lack of understanding, I felt, of the health workers, that they didn't know that they were actually allowed to pass on that information. They thought that they were doing the best thing by their client or the person that they're looking after in not passing that information on. But in fact, it was a disservice because, yeah, how can we help the person that we're caring for if we don't have this open communication and we're not working as a team? But anyway, so with Tandem, they actually organised a journalist or an ex-journalist who was wonderful, and he interviewed me and he wrote it all down for me, you know, typed it up, proofreaded it, and then that was the submission. At the time, I didn't feel strong enough or literate enough to be able to put it together myself. I was just very fortunate that they helped me do that.
And it's important that people who have lived experience and have something to say are able to contribute to these processes, because this is actually the people whose voices need to be heard. It's the people who are ultimately on a day-to-day basis affected by the decisions that are made and the unintended consequences of legislation and guidelines that actually stand in the way of people getting the care and the support that they need. So what about for you, Sue? The Mental Health Royal Commission, I'm not sure what your involvement, if any, was with that, but in advocacy generally, what have you felt able to do to advocate for yourself and for your son?
Well, there was also the commission, Royal Commission into Disabilities, and some of those submissions that were made, I had been supporting and been giving information to, like, the Down Syndrome Association. So what I found was that I would also be a signatory to their submissions. Even though I didn't submit something personally, I would support them in that way. So that was my main go-to. All the information that they would provide us that they were submitting, we had the opportunity to either be a signatory to that or contribute to it in some way, shape or form. So I did the signatory. Every Australian Counts is also another advocacy group that I am aligned with. You know, they were fairly significant in looking into the independent assessments, which has been put on hold, apparently. And also when I find sometimes the systems in those days before the NDIS, it was so convoluted and so depressing to have to go through what we had to go through in those days. I mean, I had to make Michael out to be like a demon to get 4 hours of support at his kindergarten. I mean, it was heartbreaking, you know, just saying, oh, yes, he's a danger to everybody and he's a danger to himself and, you know, this, that and the other. And in the end, they rejected it and we did have a volunteer lady come in to be at kinder with him. And then there was the searching for schools. Yeah, I want to mainstream. Let's mainstream. You know, I would go around to the local schools and it didn't take very long for you to realise that they were just paying lip service. And I thought, oh, you know, it's just everything was a battle. And then every 5 years we had to fill out a form that talked about his abilities. You know, can he use a fork? Can he eat? Can he, you know, have personal care for himself? And, you know, the Down syndrome people say, don't make it sound like he can do everything. And then at the end they would say, and is there a possibility that his condition will improve? I mean, for goodness sake, he's Down syndrome. He's always been Down syndrome. He will always be Down syndrome, you know. So you think, well, what's going on? You know, you just can't put people just in these boxes. And every 5 years I had to go through that. And it was heartbreaking. It was so depressing. And I think, oh, goodness me, you know, he's just a little boy. He just needs a little bit of support. But, you know, so in terms of anything that I needed, I would just refer back to the Down Syndrome Association first. And then, you know, obviously the peer group support, which was always generous and always sage advice that they would give us. So, but it's tough. It's, you know, and these inquiries, I think, are going a long way to help the people who have the disability or mental health issues, as well as the carers. I'm very encouraged by what's been happening. There's still probably a long way to go, but I think it can only get better.
Yeah, Yeah, I hope that you're right, and that's the plan always, is that we want to improve, and even incremental improvements can make a big difference in people's day-to-day lives. But it's great to hear that you're both feeling able to sort of step up and contribute in these forums, because your experience really, really matters. And I know that you both talk about your lived experience with other carers and advisory groups, and you've mentioned that a little bit. And Sue, I know you obviously you work at Irma 365 and you see firsthand the work that's done to support people with complex mental health conditions. I want to ask both of you, you know, what it's been like for you to work with, in Karen, in your case, working with advisory groups, and Sue, for you, you know, what it's been like working in a service like Irma 365 and, you know, accessing other carer support groups, and what are some of the needs of the other families that you speak with. Karen, you're part of an advisory group in this space. It would be great to get your perspective on the work of that group and, you know, what are the needs that you see coming out of talking to other carers who have, you know, also have needs.
I guess it's been quite inspiring hearing their stories as well. Mm. And it's the collective of all those stories together. Like, once you hear one person, you know, be brave enough to talk about what they've been through, you feel more able to do that yourself as well. You start to see how these stories collectively can make change, you know, when we band together. Mm. It's an incredible group of very strong people who've been through a hell of a lot, and particularly there's at least one person that the person that they looked after, or, you know, their loved one, unfortunately things were so tough for them that they fell through the cracks and they took their own life. And the bravery to still go on and to make a change is just very inspirational. Mm. And actually, I do apologise if that's triggering for other people too. But yeah, I'm just very honoured to be amongst these people, and I feel that there will be changes made.
Yeah. Yeah. How about for you, Sue, thinking about, you know, you're talking to other people who are carers, you know, working with them. What are the sort of some of the unmet needs perhaps that people have? And we'll talk about some of the specific recommendations from the Royal Commission in a minute. But, you know, where is the system perhaps not meeting needs now?
Well, I think from what I gain from working here at Irma and chatting to people on the phone, there's always a sense of urgency. Mm. You know, everything needs to be done straight away because it's got to the catastrophic stage of whoever it is that they're caring for, or and even service providers. You know, we really need to get such and such a kind of accommodation, or think to myself, you know, what why is it so urgent? I mean, I understand, obviously, that, you know, the crisis it needs to be addressed, but it can't happen straight away. You know, it's unpredictable. Crisis is unpredictable. Accessing services as quickly as possible is probably the thing that resonates most in the phone calls that I get working here.
So it's really, yeah, kind of early intervention and prevention. And when there's only so much money to go around, the need can tend to get concentrated around that sort of crisis response end of the need spectrum, rather than, you know, the stitch in time saves nine kind of thing, doing something early to prevent deterioration, which would be great if the service system had capacity to do that.
I mean, I did it myself when I ended up having postnatal depression. Mm. Now, there were no, I didn't recognise any signs because I hadn't heard it, I hadn't, you know, had it before. It was just that one incident when I thought, this isn't quite right. Mm. So I appreciate the urgency of everyone who calls in, their desperation. I'm not sure what the answer is. I don't, you know, there are crisis service providers out there, but I think there's a lot of things that are lacking. You know, we often talk about, you know, beds in SECU wards and things that there's insufficient. My friend's son was taken by the CAT team into a ward, and he escaped. There was no supervision and he escaped, and he was a very, very ill boy. You know, and she just doesn't get that at all, you know, but it was a situation she had to put him in involuntarily, and yet he was able to escape. I guess these commissions is exactly the vehicle we need to sort all this out.
Yeah, and access to services, I think, is a really big part of that. We did hear a lot from the submissions that were made to the Royal Commission about the no wrong door policy, you know, the idea that every door in the public support service system should be the right door, with a range of services accessible to everyone from multiple points of entry. Great, and you know, sounds like a fantastic thing to be able to do. But from your own lived experience, I'd love to hear from you both about your thoughts on what that would look like in reality, as the system undergoes change. So for you, Karen, what would no wrong door look like for you and your daughter?
I think the more that we all talk about this, and then the more that other carers kind of look out for other people and pass on what's worked for them, and you know, telling people, go and chat with your GP, mentioning the services that have been helpful, then hopefully, you know, people get help earlier on, before it reaches crisis point. So you were mentioning earlier how, you know, at school with your son, you had to fill out all the reports and sort of say the worst thing in order to get some sort of assistance. With my daughter, because she didn't harm herself or others, she didn't get help through primary school, and then through high school it didn't happen either. I changed jobs and went into the disability sector, and that learnt all about you know, speech therapy and what we could do to optimise the situation and help her through, which worked really well. But not every parent can do that. You know, I was lucky enough to get a job that enabled me to do that, and it worked in with school hours. But yeah, where I'm getting to is one of the biggest things that we did help with was actually the school counsellor. She referred us on to a nurse practitioner, and I guess that's been a good support. I guess you don't know behind which door it's going to be that you find the really good support. So I guess is, yeah, if one doesn't work, try something else, and if that doesn't work, try something else. But I guess as a community, if we talk with each other and say when we're struggling, look, even through Facebook, there's been people that have reached out to me and sort of talked about what has worked, what hasn't worked for them, and vice versa, having the conversation happening amongst carers, we really do step up and help each other quite a bit with how we can make things a bit better.
Knowing where to go and knowing how to access. Yeah, I'm interested in your thoughts on another recommendation from the Royal Commission, which was that working with families and carers and supporters is an expectation of mental health and wellbeing services. Has this been your experience with the system to date? And sounds like, Karen, it hasn't always been your experience, and that was part of your submission, that you wanted to make sure that people were able to provide information to you so that you could support your daughter. Is it something that needs to improve, and in what specific ways apart from that does, you know, working with families, carers and supporters need to improve from the service system perspective?
It would be, they have spoken about this, trying to make information packs for when people, yeah, come into a service. Like our first experience with the mental health side was when my daughter had the psychosis at school. We, you know, went to Casey, then she went to Stepping Stones, then at Monash. we were given, you know, a reasonable amount of information, but then we were referred on to another service, and I was asking for, you know, what help can I have as the carer to, I guess you're going through grief. You're going through, shit, this isn't what I expected my life to be like. And when you're in that grief-stricken shock, it would be kind of be useful to have a little care and nurture pack. Yeah, and these are the things that you can, ways in which you look after yourself. I'm seeing that happen more now. So 5 years ago, it wasn't there, but now they actually have got more help within that service. You know, they're sort of, they've got peer support. Now I actually have a peer, or, you know, someone who is gone through this and sort of out the other side, and she just sends me little notes in the mail and checks in on me, make sure I'm okay. And it's amazing how that little bit of contact can make a bit of difference. In turn, I try to do that to the other carers that I know, who I know don't have support workers, peer support, but we try and look out for each other where we can.
Mm. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on that, you know, in terms of services working with families and carers?
Yeah, I mean, initially you don't know what you don't know. And just listening to Karen there, you know, she said this person recommended her to go this way, and that way. So you're at the beck and call pretty much of what the service provider is saying. And, you know, in the state that you're in, like, you don't really understand what's happening for yourself. It's that grief thing. How do you eventually arrive at a place where you think, well, this is comfortable, if you don't know what you're supposed to be doing? Mm. And that's the thing too. And I think that's where peer groups really, really step up. I mean, we have the Down Syndrome Association coffee mornings, and as a young mum, I used to go there. I could talk to women who had older children, their experiences about school mainstreaming, and then, you know, past, you know, high school. In the end, we just let Michael go to a special school, and he's got friends that they party with, and, you know, there was no teasing. There was, like, because, you know, at some point the change in maturity changes for everyone else, but the kids get left. Michael would have got left behind, and I didn't want him to be left behind, so
yeah.
I chose special school way. And, you know, talking to these ladies about what their experience has been. And right from the get-go, we did have early intervention because, you know, as I said, Michael was born Down syndrome. So straight away we knew we had to get him into some sort of a service. They must consider the carers. We need to be informed. I mean, my situation's different to Karen's, and, you know, I'm sort of guardianship, and Michael doesn't always understand all the paperwork that goes through. Obviously, I look after all of that.
Yeah.
And it's not easy because we have to continue to fight. I still have to fight for certain things. You know, someone said to me, one of the most valuable things was one of the mums said to me, make sure you open a bank account before he turns 18 for him. And I said, why? He said, because when he turns 18, he'll have to provide the 100 points items to be able to open it. And she said, he won't have a license. He won't have a credit card, or he may have. He doesn't pay any bills. And, you know, and all that 100 point thing, I don't think he even had a passport at that stage. I went, oh, God, yes, that's right. I just picked that up now, Karen. Wow, that was so valuable. So then I became the nominated person to be able to access that account, and we've never looked back. But other parents that didn't get that advice, and it was just one of those coffee mornings conversations. Yeah. You know, it just saved me so much hassle. And I remember when I got him a passport, it said, you've got to sign in that little square. You know how pedantic they are about going over the lines. I thought, there's no way Michael could sign that. So I tick the box and say, you know, he's not able to sign. Okay, that's fine. And then I get a phone call saying, you know, why didn't he sign? And I said, because he can't sign. He has an intellectual disability. He wouldn't fit in the square. And there's a tick that says, don't have to sign if you can't. Oh, well, you know, you'll have to get a letter from the doctor to prove it. I said, to prove what? that he can't sign. I said, I ticked the box. He can't sign. I was so angry. I got onto the DFAT website and I sent a big complaint letter. But, you know, just stupid little things like that that aren't even within the mental health or disability sector. You see, why do I have to go through this? You know, I don't need a letter for my other sons. Why do I need a letter for him when they've got the box? Tick the box. But, yeah, if the commission don't look at the carers, then they're failing everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And the last question that I wanted to ask of you guys, and I think some of these things are implicit in what we've already spoken about today, including your last point, Sue. So the Royal Commission has recommended the development of key roles across the mental health and wellbeing system for people with lived experience as family members and carers. There's a recommendation around 8 care and family-led centres across the state to facilitate support and information and respite. In a nutshell, what would that look like to you? What would good look like in those centres for you?
Yeah, I guess I actually already know that they're doing a lot of consultants, sort of asking people who have mental health issues and sort of have worked through those things, they're asking them what they want.
Mm.
You know, there's the saying, nothing about me without me.
Yeah.
They're actually using that ethos, I guess, to consult with, okay, what do you need? And then getting all of that feedback.
To implement. Are there any final thoughts before we wrap up the conversation today? And I think, we may see Sue, we may not. There's some things happening with the internet. But Karen, if I can go to you, what would you like people to know? Is there anything that we haven't talked about today that you would like to mention?
Actually, Carers Victoria. I forgot to mention what a great help that they've been with a lot of their education too. So I guess getting onto their website and having a bit of a chat with them.
Yep.
The other service that I've found beneficial as a carer is Alfred Health. I believe in this area they do a lot for carers. And since lockdown, they've had something called Motivational Mornings on.
Yep.
And that's been really good to do. I've been doing Tai Chi and Qigong. It's been good to get up in the morning and have a regular thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then funnily enough, my daughter's now actually doing some of the Qigong and that's actually helping her as well. So, I guess it's good to have some starting points of where to get help.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you, Karen. Sue, we've got you back. Just asking for any other thoughts, anything that you were hoping to talk about today, perhaps that we didn't get to, any final thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the investigations into mental health and disability have been great, and I really applaud the work of the Royal Commission. I mean, it can't have been easy. It's a tough gig, and I hope the outcomes are positive. And certainly admire all those that have been brave enough to tell their stories, because some of them have been pretty horrific. And certainly thank the organisations who have, gone way out of their way to put in some submissions. And, I can't wait for the big changes that, we're all hoping for. I just hope that the governments, whoever's in at that time, that they have the strength and the courage to actually implement without harping too much on funding. I mean, it's horrible to see our children's needs and carers' needs being hijacked by the dollar. And I know that may be a bit naive, but, it's saving so much more in terms of dollars. And, they've just got to get on board. It's essential.
Mm. Yep. And I think the earlier the intervention, the less it's going to cost. I think if you wait till it gets to crisis point, it's then going to cost so much more. So
You're absolutely right. And cost is not just financial. Cost is in so many ways, Karen. I think you're both absolutely right. So on that note, I'd like to thank you both so much for taking your time out to chat to us today. It has been awesome to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thanks
to everyone for listening too.
Okay. See you. Bye.
I'm Robin Hayden and you've been listening to Get Real, Talking Mental Health and Disability. I'd like to thank Karen and Sue again very much for joining us and talking to us about reform and the hopes for carers. And Karen and Sue are both carers, and also for the people that the carers support around Victoria's mental health system and our disability systems and others that work with vulnerable people. And for our listeners, if you've been affected by anything in this conversation, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Join us next time on Get Real for more conversations about mental health and disability. And if you're enjoying the podcast, we'd love you to share Get Real with your friends and networks and subscribe to the show. That way you won't miss an episode. You can also rate and review Get Real on your preferred podcast listening platform. We're listed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Pocket Casts. Until next time, stay safe, stay well, and look after yourself. I'll see you soon.